You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeter.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Thursday, June 4th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Marcy Wheeler of EmptyWheel.net. On the Patriot Act. Or nay, Patriot Act, now Freedom Act. God, we're so free and full of patriotism. Also on the program today, if this CBS poll were a vote, Bernie Sanders would be president right now. Overwhelmingly. Also on the program, Rick Perry will announce today that he will not be president of this country, though he will be running in 2016. Elizabeth Warren sends a blistering letter to the head of the SEC, basically saying, do your job, or let somebody else in who will. Meanwhile, there are now four official candidates in the Democratic primary. Lincoln Chafee announces yesterday in Rhode Island. Hillary Clinton in Texas today to call for at least a national standard of at least 20 days of early voting. Meanwhile, a uniquely American story coming out of Disney and other countries, companies across the country using special visas. A wildfire crisis anticipated this summer, and a new report asking the question, where did all that money the Red Cross raised for Haiti relief go? Gawker unionizes. Meanwhile, some pro-TPP Democrats whine that the unions are being mean to them. They're being so rough. They're man and woman handling us. We don't like it. We don't like it, say these pro-trade Democrats. Just a reminder, this month we are being sponsored by Credo Mobile. Credo Mobile is actually via their political arm, if you will, which funds Credo Action, is one of those groups that are making these Democrats whine that there's too much pressure on them to vote against Fast Track Authority for President Obama. And I say, good for the unions, good for Credo Action. And you can help Credo Action in what they're doing, not just by going over to credoaction.org and signing up for their actions and for helping them fund their ads against Democrats who would vote in favor of this Fast Track Authority. But also, when you become a Credo Mobile member, you're helping to support Credo Action. And you're also helping to support this program, for that matter. Credo Mobile is offering a great deal for Majority Report members. Go to credomobile.com/majority report. Get $100 off all of the phones that they offer. Get $25 off 25% off of your data fees for the first year. If you're in a contract with another carrier, you get a up to $350 credit on your Credo bill towards any early termination fee. You can also get up to $300 to trade in your existing phone. So if you have, let's say, one model of a phone and you want to get the newer model, go from, you know, whatever, version 1 to version 2, or you can trade it in. You get that $100 off the phone as in addition to the trade-in value of your existing phone. These phones are near free for some of the most expensive, nicest phones that you can get. I don't know if they have any that are bedazzled, but
really?
I don't know if they have that. I don't know. But go to credomobile.com/majority report, or you can call them 800-966-1665. Mention special offer code 501-882 and get that deal. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Marcy Wheeler.
Driving on night, you could be a shadow beneath the street light. Behind my home, driving on 9, I sure miss you. Pass a motel, looking at the pines. Driving on 9, looking for 1:30. Maybe I pass.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. On the phone, it is a pleasure to welcome back to the program the proprietor of EmptyWheel.net, Marcy Wheeler. Hi, Marcy.
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for joining us. Now, obviously, the past couple of weeks have been, I guess, somewhat dramatic, although maybe the stakes aren't quite what we thought they were. Will you just walk us through what has happened in terms of the Patriot Act over the past, I guess, 3 or 4 weeks now? And then we'll start talking about really if there are any real consequences to what has taken place, at least in terms of just how much we're being surveilled.
Okay, so USA Freedom Act passed. 2 days ago, it's now signed into law, and the phone dragnet is turned back on. The central provision of USA Freedom Act would, after 6 months, so in December.
All right, hold on. Let me just back up. I mean, I think people have an awareness, I think, of what the Freedom Act is. But tell us what the Freedom Act is as opposed to the Patriot Act and why it was relevant, why we needed to pass the Freedom Act when we did.
Well, okay, so the Patriot – there were two provisions of the Patriot Act and one from another law that all expired on June 1st. And one of those, Section 215, authorized the phone dragnet plus a bunch of other stuff. And therefore, because those provisions sunset on June 1st, the government had to do something to keep the phone dragnet or some replacement for it going. And that was the real impetus for passing the USA Freedom Act this week.
Now we were sold, or at least presumably, this is reform, right? I mean, the Freedom Act basically was. Give me your assessment of the Freedom Act. I mean, it was sold in some respects as a reforming some measure of. Some measures of the Patriot Act, I guess.
The good news is it gets the government out of holding a dragnet of all of our domestic phone calls. the call records of all of our phone calls. And that's a good thing. That's sort of like, that was always sort of a unexploded nuclear bomb in the hands of the government. Other aspects of the reform, I think, in my opinion, are less certain. You know, for example, by moving the phone records to the providers, it means the FBI is going to have a lot more access to the query results. And any innocent people who are returned in that are going to be a lot more exposed to FBI scrutiny than they would have been before.
So, what does that mean? I mean, they're going to have more access to the query results.
Well, under the current program, there are actually fair, I mean, this is one aspect where the NSA defenders are correct. The rules to get into the database are somewhat restrictive, but you can only use it for counterterrorism. One of 22 people has to approve using a selector, although far more analysts can access the data than people like Michael Hayden claim. And then, more importantly, to share the results of that, of any query, you have to get a manager to sign off to say it's counterterrorism related. A lot of that will go away under the new program. The query results will go immediately both to the NSA and to the FBI. And the FBI just doesn't have those kinds of protections for Americans' records that the NSA does. So that's a trade-off that really wasn't discussed during the debate, but it is, I think, something that should get some attention.
So, I mean, so if I understand it from a sort of a conceptual basis, under the Patriot Act and under the, the 215, the government was housing all this stuff and basically creating almost like a library of time, if you will, of all of these of all this data, and the rules for accessing it were more restrictive than they are now. But the fear was down the road, if you've got this, and you referred to it as basically sitting on a nuclear bomb, if you've got all this information, it becomes the rules for access could easily degrade over time, and it just becomes this sort of free for all. Whereas now the access is limited up front, but whatever comes out of that system, because now it's being housed by these carriers, is less protected.
Yeah, partly because it'll go in. The NSA has since 2000. Arguably 2007, since 2008 at least, it's been trying to move more of this surveillance to FBI, because once it gets into FBI's hands, the data can be shared both for more purposes, but also with a lot more people more easily. So in other words, whereas now the NSA has to jump through some hoops to even share it with the FBI, starting in December or whenever this new program goes into effect, the FBI is going to be able to share it right down to a local cop fairly easily. So you see the difference there. And that's been, I think, a conscious effort on the part of the intelligence community since 2008 to make this data more accessible by making FBI a more central player in it.
So it almost as if it becomes laundered, the information. It no longer has the sort of like radioactive quality to it as it gets mainstreamed.
Yeah, right.
Okay.
And so, I mean, so the bill has a lot of trade-offs like this, which are not to mean that the fundamental thing of getting the government out of the business of holding. But and the other thing to remember too, Sam, is that this affects just domestic phone records. On Monday and Tuesday, when the phone dragnet was shut down, the NSA was still collecting all of the phone records that you make international. So, like, I couldn't, you know, they weren't collecting records of my calls to my mother in Philadelphia, but they were collecting records of my calls to my mother-in-law in Ireland. And that still goes on. And that doesn't have any of the kind of protections that I just talked about. And that's one of the things, I mean, this bill only touches a really narrow part of the NSA's spying, and there are lots of abusive practices that remain in place.
And so give me a sense of how all of this was implicated by, I guess it was the Second Circuit a couple of, I don't know if it was a month ago now, ruled that the way the government was interpreting parts of 215 in terms of specifically, I guess, the word relevant was illegal. Where does that come into this?
So What the Second Circuit said was when Congress added that relevant to language to the bill, and they added it, by the way, in 2005, 2006, when they added that language, they had no intention of authorizing the collection of every phone call made in the United States. And so the Second Circuit decision undercuts not just the secret decision that the FISA court made about the phone dragnet, but also the secret decision that the FISA court made about the defunct internet dragnet and possibly some other things. So it basically said the FISA court's interpretation of the law passed by Congress was nuts, which is true. It was nuts. And Congress had no intention of authorizing this dragnet of every American's phone record.
All right. Well, so let me ask you this. I mean, is this the first time an appellate court was able to address what the FISA court ruled upon? Because that was one of the things that I think I think it was the Snowden revelations that first, at least it maybe came to my attention, was just that you've got the FISA court doing this, and there's really no way for anybody to, or there wasn't anyways, any way to address the lawmaking that was essentially happening with the FISA court. And the idea of a court making law is not in and of itself particularly surprising in our system. That happens all the time. It's just that it is done in daylight, and you have a subsequent court all the way up to the Supreme Court, or a higher court, that will at least has the opportunity to address the law making that the court has done, and then, you know, or you want to call it law interpretation. So is this the first time like the FISA court, a ruling by the FISA court, has been in any way scrutinized by another court?
It's not the only time, because the appeals courts have reviewed, although not very aggressively, the use of traditional warrants against defendants. So the only person who's ever been able to get standing to challenge these things has been a criminal defendant, which means, you know, there's a whole range of uses of this spying that will never be checked because they're not used for criminal enforcement. But in the cases where data from a traditional FISA warrant has been used against a defendant, some circuit courts have reviewed that and basically upheld it. We're only now getting into the point, in fact, the Ninth Circuit is due to review one of these. We're only now getting into the point where circuit courts are reviewing the PRISM application, where they collect information on Americans based on targeting somebody overseas and sometimes go back and find it years after the fact. That's only now being reviewed by circuit courts. The ACLU tried to challenge PRISM, and in a kind of famous ruling, Sam Alito said that, you know, that you're being collected on is speculative, even though everything that Edward Snowden has shown to us is that it wasn't speculative at all. In fact, the ACLU has been spied on, surely. But they'll still never be able to get standing on the 702 side, whereas because of the order that Snowden leaked was for Verizon, and Verizon carries both the cell and the landline traffic for ACLU, they were very easily able to say, look, we've been affected by this. We're a good plaintiff.
So, I mean, at the very least, Snowden allowed for the court cases to proceed because it was easier for people to prove – it became possible for them to prove standing.
Right.
So where are we left now? I mean, the Freedom Act has passed. What is the status of – I mean, when you look at this stuff, and, you know, I think it is not a very controversial statement to say that you are probably one of the foremost experts on this in the country, at least that are writing publicly about this.
It is true. I need a better hobby.
Well, it's stunning because you can't, it's almost impossible. I should just tell this to people. It's impossible to read anyone who is writing about any of this where they don't cite you. In some fashion, what when you look at this stuff, give me your sense of what you think is the most troubling, remains the most troubling in terms of these provisions.
We're talking about spying on Americans, or we're talking about abuse generally.
Well,
I think the spying on Americans it still is that the FBI can get the content that they collect off of a foreign conversation you have without even any suspicion of wrongdoing, which is, and they do that. They do go in and access this content at the assessment level before they have any evidence that you've committed a crime to see whether you've had any interesting conversations with people that they think might be interesting, against whom they don't even need any evidence of wrongdoing. So that's just crazy. And it's something that I think Ted Poe is the latest to try and fix via appropriations. Tom Massey and Zoe Lofgren tried to do it last year. And that was not only neglected in USA Freedom Act, but back in November when USA Freedom Act was admittedly a better bill, the transparency procedure still hid that. They wouldn't even require FBI to count how many such searches they do on American people, and probably the reason why is because Americans, if they let us know how often they're doing that, then we'd be outraged and we would have a much easier legal argument to make that it's unreasonable. But the other thing is that, as I explained before, they're still collecting all my calls with my mother overseas, right? My mother-in-law, sorry. No offense to either of them. They're also still collecting a ton of internet metadata and content overseas because it's available, including of Americans. And the rules on accessing that data are much more liberal, much more lenient than the rules even going ahead on the phone dragnet. So in other words, if they collect my email metadata overseas, they can access it for any reason. It doesn't have to be counterterrorism. It can be they think I'm involved in crime. It can be drugs. It can be, any foreign intelligence reason. And so... that stuff really implicates Americans' privacy, and it's not being overseen by the FISA court. It's not being overseen by Congress closely enough. And the government wants to avoid any restriction on that. And so that's another practice that really needs to be reined in.
What authorities do both those practices, what gives them the authority supposedly to do so?
Okay, so the first one, which is accessing content without a warrant, the content gets collected primarily but not exclusively under Section 702, which is PRISM. So they have to target somebody overseas, but mind you, because they can access all this metadata, they can also find out somebody who's been having interesting conversations with the U.S., right? But they have to target my mother-in-law to collect our phone records, and then those phone records would just sit in an FBI database for 30 years, and any time they find me to be of interest, they'll do a search and pull up all the conversations with interesting foreigners. So that's PRISM. The other one's EO-12333, which is not a law. It's an executive order.
This is the Reagan-era executive order. Is that right?
Yeah. Basically, in the wake of the Church Committee, Congress decided not to legally limit what the president could do overseas. And they did so partly because a series of presidents, Ford, then Carter, then Reagan, said, here's what we promise or what we sort of promise to do, so don't make any rules prohibiting any of this stuff. In fact, there are numerous cases where the executive does violate those rules, including on surveillance. But it basically, the law that authorizes that is Article 2 of the Constitution. And one of the debates we're going to have going forward is how much Congress can limit that spying without overstepping its bounds under the Constitution. And I think there's probably a lot more that Congress could do because the spying they're doing on Americans goes well beyond foreign power spying. But.
Has that executive order gotten a lot more use over the past 15 years than it had prior, or has that been something that's been ongoing?
Well, it's always ongoing. I mean, that executive order governs everything that happens overseas, and frankly, before the internet became so central to communications, it governed satellite communications, which was the bulk of what the NSA did. So, having internet communications being governed by FISA, because the collection happens in the United States, is a relatively new thing, for better and for worse. But along with that, I mean, you and I didn't communicate via satellite. You and I communicate by internet all the time. You know, so along with that is the government's just doing a lot more spying because they can't. They can, right. they can do it on an industrial scale, and almost all of it. I mean, the phone dragnet is just a tiny fraction of what the NSA does. And the rest, you know, most of the rest of the spying that goes on is under 12333.
When you talk about the FBI under, I guess, 702, can go on these more or less these phishing expeditions. Well, do you have a sense of, like, practically how that works? In other words, is there a division of people at the FBI who are just like, let's start today in the G's, and they just start fishing? Or is it that just over the course of an investigation, a name pops up and they go looking for it? Or what? Or they read an article about some vegans protesting out in front of a, you know, a ham factory, and they just dip in? I mean, what from a practical standpoint, how does this happen? If they can go anywhere, how do they even just sort of decide where they're going to go?
Well, okay, it'll happen in all of the situations you've talked about. The FBI at the assessment level can investigate people they have a tip about but don't have any real evidence. And one of the things they'll do in those circumstances is search these databases. So if they have a tip that, you know, and they do it not just for national security investigations. So the bulk of what FBI gets is national security content. So that's one instance. You know, this guy who may want to behead a cop, let's see if he's had any conversations with anyone overseas. Although, by the way, I think FIFA could easily be targeted under PRISM. And so I think it's not outside the realm of possibility that some of the investigation into FIFA was done under them as being a transnational crime organization, which of course they were.
This is the soccer
governing body, which right. just got busted. But another application where they'll use it, for example, is to find informants. So, and they do that both with metadata and content, but it may be that, you know, they have a mosque where they think is an extremist mosque, and they'll do a search to see if there's anybody they know that they can coerce into turning into an informant. And they actually use it in that way. Another thing that they would get.
Do they have access when they're looking for that informant, let's say? Do they have access to the content? So is that the case? I mean, can they actually like listen into the calls at that point?
It's going to be mostly email, but yes, because that's an assessment, and at the assessment level, they can access this information. What probably happens is, you know, that they'll be targeting, say, an imam of a mosque and do the phone chaining thing or the internet chaining thing via a variety of means. And look at that chain and say, here's somebody who might make a promising informant to
right.
get to that imam.
They're talking, they find that guy and his mom is ill and he's facing bankruptcy, or he is cheating on his wife.
Right,
okay.
Right. And so, in fact, in 2002, before PRISM, Ted Olson, who at least is an honest hawk on these issues, argued to the FISA court that it could be that rape would be a national security issue on traditional FISA warrants because they might find evidence of a rape and then use it to coerce somebody into turning an informant. So that argument has been in place long before some of these, you know, before FISA got involved in some of these, that they'll use the content of these things to go convince somebody to be an informant. And then the last one, which is very similar to your vegan.
I mean, that basically, just to stop on that for a moment and make people understand that basically means that just about anything that is something that other people wouldn't want them to know about, regardless of what it was, like I have excessive back hair. I mean, whatever it is could be tied into national security if the argument could be made like, oh, well, this is something that we could leverage to get them to become an informant.
Right, but remember, there's got to be a way to collect it. So you know, that rape conversation is going to come up either from somebody who's legally targeted under traditional FISA or a conversation overseas, because PRISM,
okay,
where the targeting level is lower, has to be with somebody overseas, or something in a public database. And there is a part of, you know, like there's a part of FBI that's going to do these searches. The vegan example you brought up, I don't know that they would use it. They might use it against vegans or you know, ACTA, the anti-animal rights activists. But one area where they would clearly use it is, for example, there's a huge Somali community in the Twin Cities, and they might, there's another use of informants, of assessments to kind of figure out where the potential threats might be. And so they might search on Somalis in the St. Paul area to find out, not to find out any evidence of crime, but just to see how tied into Somalia, how many people are having conversations that might be tied to Al-Shabaab. So in other words, there's no crime that's going to elicit this search. It's just an awareness that they might want to find more information about, you know, about Somali Americans or what have you. So those are all purposes that the FBI can use assessments for, and at the assessment level, they can get into this content. And that's why it's so outrageous, is that, you know, again, they don't need to have any evidence of wrongdoing or even be searching for any evidence of wrongdoing to get to this content. They may just use the content for other purposes that are investigative, kind of secondhand.
I mean, it occurs to me that in some respects, when you start to talk about all of these sort of supposed restrictions, because they're so easily, just bypassed in some way or another, that the restrictions actually become more of a fig leaf, right? Like the restrictions actually become useful to the national security apparatus, because it's a way of selling the idea that, look, we have restrictions, when in fact they don't.
Right. I mean, let me give you an example. Like Michael Hayden was out today saying, oh, Section 215 is not as bad as you say, only, you know, it's only phone records. But what he doesn't say, and I actually did a post on this today and yesterday, what he doesn't say is that if your phone record comes up, okay, if you're 2, and it used to be 3, degrees away from somebody of interest, that's when things start getting interesting, because that's when both the NSA and the FBI, with different restrictions in each place, can start unpacking your life. You know, Sam, you know I'm 2 degrees away from a lot of these people, especially, you know, Edward Snowden type. If you're 2 degrees away from those people, then they may start unpacking your life for a variety of reasons, and they may not find any evidence of crime, but that just means they will have done the initial work on an investigation of you and left it sitting in a database in the FBI.
So down the road. So you wrote a couple of posts about the Inspector General review of the that was happening within the FBI. Tell us what that review, why the FBI was stalling that review, and what that review found, and why that's relevant to what we're talking about.
Well, there were actually a couple of reviews. One was on Section 215 as a whole. And one of the things that came out of that was, at least through 2009, Section 215 as a whole had never been all that useful for finding any criminals. There was also a Stellar Wind one, which was released earlier in May. The New York Times liberated it. And that one has some evidence about how useless the early versions of this phone dragnet are. The FBI tried to put some numbers on whether it was useful or not, and it really wasn't all that useful. It also, that report raised the issue which I just did, which is that a lot of people who are completely innocent get investigated by the FBI because of these tippers, and that data resides then forward in an FBI database. So there's a lot of issues about these programs that should have been more public before this debate. The Section 215 one literally came the week of the House passage, and it showed, you know, not only did it show that Section 215 hasn't been all that useful, but it shows that from 2006, when Congress told FBI it needed to have additional minimization procedures to protect Americans' privacy. This is the FBI, not NSA. Until 2013, they had not followed the law. They had basically blown off this requirement to impose additional protections for Americans until after the Edward Snowden revelation made everyone a lot more worried about Section 215. So, you know, when you have Marco Rubio go on TV and say there's been no evidence of abuse, there's plenty of evidence that FBI hasn't been following the rules and that the FISA court permitted it to continue to do so. There's plenty of evidence that the FBI in particular, and I think on this part, the FBI is significantly worse than the NSA. The FBI in particular isn't doing what it needs to do to protect innocent Americans' privacy.
And have we seen like actual examples of they're blowing off the protections? But have we seen the specific examples, and it's obviously very difficult to tell, of abuse? And I guess it's also a definition of how you say abuse. I mean, because this is what I hear quite often from people who are like, look, it's true. The only thing that Snowden has maybe revealed is that there's the potential for abuse, but the actual abuse hasn't happened. There may be flouting of the protections for Americans, but the things that we're trying to protect them against haven't happened.
Well, I mean, it's wrong partly because even the NSA was comparing some of the stuff that got caught doing in 2009 with Project Minaret. So, you know, there was a point in 2009 where they were...
Tell people what Project Minaret is.
Project Minaret was a kind of phone tracking that they did against... African-American leaders, some members of Congress, some other dissidents, that's very similar to today's phone dragnet. But they were tracking these people because they were politically interesting. And we know that in 2009, the NSA had an alert list that included 3,000 presumed U.S. persons, and they didn't do what is required, which is that you do a First Amendment review to make sure you're not doing it just because of their religion or their politics. And when they were caught doing that, they just moved all that back under 12333. They just, you know, said, okay, we won't do this alert list on domestically collected records. We'll just move it back under foreignly collected records and be done with it. But there are also instances. I mean, part of the reason we say there aren't abuses today is because we treat Muslim faith communities differently than we now historically, although it wasn't true at the time, than we now historically treat black churches that were central to the civil rights organization. And by that I mean the spying on Martin Luther King Jr. was largely legal until 1971. As the spying on the leader of CARE, which is one of the Intercept had a story about six Muslim or Iranian or various other basically Muslim organizations that were being spied on under FISA, traditional FISA. But the implications of that are, for example, CARE, I raised him, the head of CARE, was one of those targets, is that if you're a traditional FISA target, that also means that they can do this phone dragnetting on you without any additional review. So in other words, you start spying on the head of an organization, same way you start spying on Martin Luther King Jr., and you automatically get to spy on anybody 2 or 3 degrees away from that person. You automatically get to see the phone network and the internet network of that person, and that's incredibly powerful if you're going to treat that civil liberties organization as an adversary, as the FBI still to this day institutionally does. And yet, so I don't see how that's all that different from spying on civil rights leaders in the 60s. But I think the public treats Muslims differently than
right.
we treated black Christians.
Right.
You know.
Or at least the way that they look back in retrospect, right? I mean, the reality is in 1968, I'm sure there was a huge number of Americans, white Americans anyways, who were like, well, I hope the government's keeping an eye on this guy. Or 1965 or
And so that's really, I mean, I don't know that they're using this against vegans, but I can guarantee you they're using it against Muslims and against Muslim-based communities. We've had a lot of people reporting out that both these organizations have been shelled, but also mosques themselves, which might have been kind of the place to have a political discussion about whether our wars in the Middle East are fair. And that discussion has been chilled. That leadership has been chilled because those mosques are infiltrated by informants. And we know that. And the informants, again, one source, not the only one, but one source of where they get those informants is from these dragnets. So, you know, to some degree, they just automated the process that they used against certainly the African American community during the Civil Rights era. And most people don't make that connection. You know, that seems odd to us. But I believe it is very parallel to what they were doing.
So lastly, I mean, in terms of opportunity to reform, particularly these things you've talked about in terms of the FBI, but just more broadly speaking, is it over for the time being in Congress? Are we now basically just going to have to wait for various court cases? If so, which ones should we be looking for?
Well, one court case which might get interesting is, as I said, the Ninth Circuit is going to review the 702 wiretapping of a guy named Mohammed Mahmoud who was picked up using 702. So that'll be an interesting one. The ACLU just wrote an amicus for that yesterday. As far as legislative work, what I think came out of this debate, and especially of the, you know, the additional 7 months after November, is that we had kind of a broad coalition that included progressives and libertarians last year. I think the edge from the kind of outside edge of the libertarian progressives have gotten more insistent in the interim period. And have, you know, like or hate Rand Paul, but by refusing to let McConnell pass a short-term reauthorization of some of these provisions, now 2 weeks ago, Rand Paul really made it hard for the people who claim to want to support the United States to not vote for USA Freedom Act.
Right.
Mitch McConnell suffered a tremendous defeat, and he suffered it partly because Rand Paul is a jerk. And, you know, I mean that in a very complimentary way. And partly because Mike Lee, who did the inside track, really was whipping votes very well and had the threat of Rand Paul, the threat that Rand Paul had created on the outside. And a similar dynamic, I think, is going on in the House now. So there are, you know, for example, Tom Massey passed another effort to get NSA out of the business of setting encryption standards. Ted Poe, I think, is the one who... And Jared Polis, I'm forgetting who did what, but one of them is working on the backdoor searches, which I just walked you through, the 702 stuff. But meanwhile, the kind of inside groups are trying to reform ECPA, which is to give our stored email more protection, among other things. So there are, and then we have a fight, which is a defensive fight. The government wants to pass CISA, which is the Cyber Intelligence Sharing Act, which really would gut ECPA, and this same coalition, I think, is going to be in place to try and fight that, which would give it would make it a lot easier for corporations to share information with the government, and then for that to be instantaneously shared throughout the government. So
interesting.
That's one of the next big fights.
Marcy Wheeler, thanks so much for walking us through this stuff. Really appreciate your time today.
Thanks so much.
All right, folks. Weedy stuff. But very important.
Fuse that up with King v. Burwell and look at you, listeners of the Majority Report.
Yes.
You are an absolute terror and bore at every future party and dinner party you ever go to.
We will put these links on that. But I went yesterday. I did one of the internet shows on MSNBC. It's called The Shift. I don't know. They have a bunch of different names for it, but it's Dorian Warren's show. I think they call it Nerding Out. They have the most There's a dash.
You love that name.
I love that name. I don't love that name. But what I just find stunning about what MSNBC is doing on their internet thing is that it's nerding out. There's actually like a hyphen in the URL for the show, which I just think that like sort of just from a best practices standpoint, like this is stuff that like, you know, in like 2002, you'd go like, hey, you probably don't want that hyphen in there. From my experience. But, you know, it's dial-up. So, I went in there, and we're talking Social Security. So Dorian says, you know, thanks for coming in talking about Social Security. And I'm like, are you kidding? This is my favorite thing to talk about. And he just sort of looked at me like, really? Like, I can't remember what he said, but it led me to, like, sort of realize, like, even if this guy who's doing a show on it is surprised at the level of enthusiasm I have for this, I may.
That'd be a great bit. Like everybody else is sort of, he's calling in a chip with sort of. There's, yeah, all right, anything for you, Dorian. You show up with like a binder.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like, I'm ready for the Social Security convo, guys.
Yes, I think one of the other guests, she was remote, was Nancy Altman from Social Security Works. Mm-hmm. And
she might have a degree of enthusiasm.
I still think it embarrasses her.
I do this a living. I'm not.
Sam, calm down.
Jesus.
Just calm down. We get it. Social Security's great.
Behave with some dignity, please. Okay. But Sam is right. Just not dignified.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break and head into the fun half of the program, and we'll be joined there by people who support both the free show and the member show. Well, in fact, they support the free show. They make the free show possible. And as a thank you to them, we give them the extra member show. And then, of course, there's also the thank you that's generated by the sense of pride and the sense of ownership and the can-do spirit involved in, you know, every time we put on a show, it is because of our members, period. Yes, Credo Mobile is sponsoring us this month, and God bless them. You can go to credomobile.com/majority report, get that great deal they're offering. But we don't get Credo, we don't get sponsors that often, and to the extent that we do get offers for sponsors, we don't do them very often. You know, we'll do Harry's because shaving blades, it's a good shaving blade. I've used it. I believe in the product, but it's, and I'm happy to promote it. But Credo, I'm like, you know, frankly, if they weren't sponsoring the program, I wouldn't remind me to talk about them as much. But we certainly have. I've had Becky Bond on this program for years before the idea that they would sponsor us was even an issue. So I'm really happy that they're a sponsor. But at the end of the day, it's the members. You can also support this program by going to justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. That's another win-win-win. It's a co-op, employee-owned. Their coffee, all fair trade. In other words, everyone in the supply line gets a fair wage for what they're doing. Another win, you get 10% off with the coupon code MAJORITY. Another win, you can get Majority FM Blend. Every time you buy the Majority FM Blend instead of the WTF blend that Mark Maron's face is on, Mark Maron gets a gray hair. Yes. It's like the opposite of Juju in the petals. In the angels are getting the wings. Also, if you buy crap from Amazon, the least you can do is buy it through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. Go there, click on the link, bookmark it. Always buy your Amazon crap from there if you buy crap from Amazon, and we get a kickback. Number 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. What's that? We're going to get a campaign update from Right Wing Mandela, what, in the second half of the show, or what are you saying? Maybe we'll save that for tomorrow. Tomorrow on the program, Cliff will not be with us, so I'll be talking to Charlie Pierce, the great Charlie Pierce. All right, 646-257-3920 if you want to be a part of the program. Of course, you can IM me. You can IM me through the app, which you can pick up at majorityapp.com. Or you can IM me using the IM handle Majority FM on your... Oh, I should turn that on. On your IM clients. All right, ladies and gentlemen. We'll be... Oh, we got a lot of fun sound in the fun half today. Alex Jones. Not going to come as a shock. Somehow worked in both the notion that we're on the brink of a civil war and that Caitlyn Jenner is alive into the same commentary. Glenn Beck. Man, that's the problem. When you go to that apocalypse thing the first time and the second time, the third time, the fourth time, and the fifth time, by the time you get to about 120, people don't listen. But I just want Glenn to know we're still listening. Except for us. We can hear you. We'll be right back after this.